Hello, this is a free call from an offender at Clemens Unit. This call is being recorded and is subject to monitoring. To accept this free call, press 1. To refuse this free call, press 2. Thank you for using
CenturyLink.
You may start the conversation now.
The term mass incarceration was something I never heard of, and it was because it was normal.
All the units I've been on, majority of the inmates are Black and Hispanic.
He just celebrated his 26th birthday on September 26th in there. And that's where he's growing up at, because of the mistakes he made when he was 18 years old.
See, I was a pawn in a game that I knew nothing about.
That's what hinders my community the most, is that shame and stigma, because then you don't look further into it.
You can learn this game too. You can learn the rules, the way it's designed. You don't have to live the way you used to live. The world needs to know about this shit. The effect it does have on family members.
Hey, Nicole, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Sean?
I am full of wonder and joy as much as I can be, despite the craziness of the world around us.
Yeah.
So you have another episode of this fantastic podcast.
I do.
Episode 2.
Do you know what it's called?
It's called something like Slavery Didn't Exist.
No.
Wait, slavery didn't end, it evolved.
There you go. It's a quote from Bryan Stevenson. So yeah, it kind of summarizes what we're going to be talking about, which is how mass incarceration is an extension of slavery.
Definitely. Discrimination, racial injustice in the prison system.
Mm-hmm. There is a really robust conversation happening in academic circles about the causes of mass incarceration. The root psychological, emotional, cultural, economic conditions that enabled this thing to happen. So one major strand focuses on the racist history of the U.S. and the history of white supremacy, and makes a very convincing and compelling argument that racism and this legacy of slavery that we still haven't reconciled is a primary driving factor behind this. And so today we're going to focus on that piece of the puzzle.
The war on drugs is racially motivated too.
We're actually going to be talking about that in the next episode a lot. So the next episode is going to be about the modern escalation of the war on drugs. But for today, in the first segment, I'm going to run through the history. And I'm going to be interviewed by my friend Paul, who has some personal connections to this issue himself. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we'll take a break. And in the second half, we're going to hear from my friend Melissa and her brother Marcus about what the impact of reading the book The New Jim Crow had on their lives, given that they grew up in an area where almost everybody that they know has had run-ins with the law or is incarcerated.
That sounds, I don't want to say it sounds awesome, but as far as the podcast goes, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sounds good. Looking forward to that.
All right, here we go. Paul Braverman, how's it going?
Hi, Nicole. It's going great.
Cool. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Maybe we should just dive in to the questions.
Yeah, okay. Sure. You know, the title of the episode is Slavery Didn't End, It Evolved. basically, how can you explain that to me? Like, how is mass incarceration, how is that related to slavery?
Yeah, thank you. So the arguments that I'm going to be making here are based on a few different sources. The most famous of them would be Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. And there are a lot of parallels between mass incarceration, like the practices of mass incarceration, and the practices that we saw during the time of slavery in terms of forced labor or exploited labor, in terms of the concentration of incarceration among Black Americans. But for today, I'm not going to focus so much on those parallels as much as on the historical trajectory that begins at slavery and ends where we are right now. So looking at this evolution historically, and that quote, "Slavery didn't end, it evolved," is from Bryan Stevenson, the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative and a very prominent lawyer who has litigated some very important cases in front of the Supreme Court. And it basically summarizes the argument that Michelle Alexander makes in five words. You know, it's like the best, most pithy summary of the argument. So to begin with, we're going to start at the end of slavery in 1865 with the Emancipation Proclamation, which ushered in this period that we call Reconstruction, right? So between 1865 and 1877, this plantation system has broken down. Slave labor is no longer legal. And there's this kind of moment of hope and excitement and uncertainty and tumultuousness going on in the South, where the old economic system and the system that had entrenched segregation between Black Southerners and white Southerners had disintegrated, right? What ended up happening starting in 1877 is that the Jim Crow laws were put on the books. So Jim Crow was like the answer to the question of what is the new social structure that entrenches this segregation between Blacks and whites? Like, what is that going to look like in this new era, right? So the Jim Crow laws, as I think many people know, legally barred Blacks from attending the same schools as whites, from attending the same lunch counters as whites, right? It like created a ban on the mixing of Blacks and whites in public and private spaces. Mm-hmm. And these laws were also backed up not only legally, but also by these extra legal forces such as the KKK, right? So you have the rise of the KKK, who are terrorizing the Black community when they feel like somebody is getting out of line or transgressing these legal rules around mixing. And stemming from the KKK, but not only from them, you have what Bryan Stevenson calls racial terror lynchings. So the Equal Justice Initiative documented 4,075, quote, racial terror lynchings in the 12 most active Southern states from 1877 to 1950. And racial terror lynchings are distinguished from other types of lynchings that may have happened during that time. So they're distinguished based on the explicit motivation behind the lynching. So lynching being one of the mechanisms outside of the law that was used to instill fear and terror in the Black community, such that there was little motivation and effort to try to break down some of these laws, these Jim Crow laws. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I've never read the specifics of the Jim Crow laws, you know?
Yeah.
I always hear how awful they were, and I guess I just never realized, because up until like it's the Supreme Court, I guess, struck down separate but equal,
right,
they were essentially no upward mobility possible for the most part?
Well, I mean, I think that's a complicated question. Like, you know, I wouldn't want to kind of be heavy-handed in say, no, nobody was able to rise above their circumstances. Okay. Like, yes, there were certainly people, you know, in these segregated communities, Black people were not allowed to use the same restrooms or frequent the same businesses or whatever as, you know, the white community, but they were founding their own schools, founding their own businesses, founding their own, right? So within the Black community itself, there was some ability to be upwardly mobile. You know, it's a complex dynamic. And of course, there's also people who flee the South during this period and go to the North. So the Jim Crow era and these racial terror lynchings usher in the first wave of the Great Migration, which leads a lot of the African American individuals and families from the South to head to Chicago, Detroit, New York City, Baltimore, right? All of these industrial northern cities where, so this is an important point because during the Jim Crow era, those Jim Crow laws were what was entrenching segregation in the South. But there were other mechanisms that were entrenching segregation in the North and ultimately also in Western cities during the second wave of the Great Migration, which was around World War II. So in the northern cities, you have the quote-unquote Black ghetto. And when I talk about the ghetto, I want to be clear about what I mean, because the term ghetto has a lot of different uses, and some of them are derogatory. So what a ghetto is just, you know, historically speaking, a place where a particular group, whether it's based on race or ethnicity or religion, is formally or informally contained. Right. So it's a neighborhood, essentially, or a geographic region where those particular people are restricted to living. So in these northern cities, and then also eventually in the western cities, there are a whole host of informal discriminatory housing policies that maintain their segregation in specific areas. So one of those is what's called redlining, which is where the housing bureaus and like the different entities involved in making housing policy and zoning policy in the cities took out maps of the city and drew red lines around the areas where it was where white people lived, where Black people could live, and then sometimes there were buffer zones too, where it was like a more of like a mixed race area. And so that determined like what kind of loan you could get, who you could give that kind of home loan to, right? So it was like this, it wasn't something that was legally entrenched, but it was a ubiquitous practice of having this kind of segregated map that determined where it was Black people could live. And you can go online and find the redlining maps of any major city in the U.S.
North and South.
No, North and West.
North and West.
In the South, the Jim Crow laws were on the books as a legal remedy to the issue of racial mixing.
Okay.
Right? So another piece of this housing discrimination was what were known as racial covenants. So these are lines in a, like if you're buying a home, it's a line in the contract that you sign when you buy the home that specifies that if you sell the home, you have to sell it to somebody of your same race.
Really?
Yes. So this is another common practice that entrenched, again, those lines of segregation. So, you know, this is probably in Philly, you've had this experience, and many people, you know, in Oakland, I certainly did, and in San Francisco, I certainly did, where there's like, it's like you drive from one street to the next, and you can just feel a difference.
Of course.
Right? In terms of who's walking around on the street, like the whole vibe is different. It's, there's just these lines in the city. Well, how did those lines happen? You know, well, this is how they happened.
Okay.
Like it's not just coincidence, or it's not just like, oh, birds of a feather flock together or whatever, you know, like chances are if you look at the redlining map of that city, you'll see a red line down that street.
I think it's worthwhile for me to do like a little Google search after this.
Yeah.
See what happened.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. It'll start to make sense. So.
So did it get better? Like how long did it like take? I guess like 90 or so years, right?
Well, so what happened was the civil rights movement.
Right.
Yeah. So in the 1950s, right, we see Rosa Parks. So we see it start in the South with these movements that are specifically targeting the Jim Crow laws, with the people coming down, you know, the buses coming down from the northern cities and people purposefully disrupting the lunch counters, purposefully desegregating the schools, purposefully sitting down on the bus. So you see these movements that are directly taking on the Jim Crow laws in the South, but we also see these urban riots that happen in northern cities like Detroit or Watts in LA, and actually all over the place. So those are the most famous, but they were happening all over the place. You see the Black Power and the Brown Power movements, and these massive federal legislation packages like the Voting Rights Act and the Equal Employment Opportunity Act that start chipping away at not only the Jim Crow laws, but also all of this informal segregation and discrimination that was happening at the same time in the North and the West.
Right.
Right? So basically, starting, I would say, maybe like 1955, like wherever you want to kind of place the mark of the beginning of the civil rights movement, to the early 70s, you have another period of time of major civil unrest, of major legal remedies that are breaking down the structures that have been entrenched since the end of Reconstruction, that have maintained segregation. You see tumultuousness and intense public debate and all of this hope too, right? With leaders like Martin Luther King coming forward and Malcolm X and, you know, the Black Panthers and all of this kind of hope for what might be possible in this moment. And then the question is, well, what did happen next, right? We made all of these kind of gains towards equality. And then starting in 1972, we see the declaration of the war on drugs, right, by Richard Nixon. And in 1973, that is the year that incarceration rates begin rising sharply and steadily across all 50 states and the federal system.
So Nixon is kind of like a sort of famously known, besides Watergate, as being like an anti-Semite and just like a pretty terrible person sometimes in terms of his attitude towards certain groups of people.
Sure.
Was it like racially motivated, the war on drugs, or did he just see straight stats on his like papers that drug use is rising and then this is causing people to die or like go ill and like the country's in need, or was it racially motivated?
Yeah. So that is a great question. The first thing to note is that every law that has prohibited some form of drug has been connected to rhetoric that demonizes a particular ethnic or racial minoritized group.
Okay.
So starting in 1875, which was the first drug ban in the country, it was passed in San Francisco. It was an anti-opium bill, and it was related to Chinatown. Chinese people who had migrated to the Western U.S. for the gold rush and then to work on the railroads, and who were living in a Chinese ghetto, Chinatown, and the press at the time made a very big deal about how these white women were being seduced into these opium dens in Chinatown and were, you know, smoking opium and getting loose.
Right, falling under the sway of the Chinamen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also to get back to the lynchings, just to draw this connection, over and over and over again, there is a theme around the protection of white women from these hypersexualized men of color. So in the lynchings, many lynchings were spurred by an allegation that a black man had whistled at a white woman or had made some kind of gesture or statement towards a white woman that was deemed sexual. So that question of miscegenation, of like the mixing of races and the protection of white women from the desires of these men, is a huge underlying theme in all of this. So 1875, opium is the first drug ban. In 1914, cocaine and opiates are banned by the U.S. Congress via the Harrison Act. And I'm going to read a title from a New York Times article in 1914. The title of this New York Times article is "Negro Cocaine Fiends Are a New Southern Menace." Subtitle: "Murder and Insanity Increasing Among Lower Class Blacks Because They Have Taken to Sniffing Since Deprived of Whiskey by Prohibition."
Yeah, I kind of, when you were speaking about the first drug ban, you mentioned journalism.
It's manipulating anxiety over job security, over, you know, our kind of predisposition to be distrustful of the other.
Right.
Right. You know, using that to stir up what some sociologists have called a quote unquote moral panic, which kind of gets at this idea of like the frenzy and the overblown rhetoric that's being used at the time that everybody is kind of, you know, that's being stirred up and by both by the media, but then also like in common conversation. And
so the Civil Rights Act and that whole era.
Yeah.
The racist motivated or not, like the answer to that was mass incarceration by this, like the state, like.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the point that I'm trying to make is not that Nixon or, you know, his cronies or whatever devised mass incarceration as the answer.
Yeah.
What I'm doing is pointing to a historical pattern.
Okay.
So this question of explicit racist motivation and how much that drove mass incarceration is a complicated question.
Yeah.
It definitely did drive it. It is definitely a factor, but it's also not the only factor.
Yeah.
It's a very complex phenomenon, and there's a lot of different stuff that all happened at the same time that drove it. But the point of looking back on it through this lens is to say, this is what has happened. Not necessarily this is why it happened, but just that this, like when you look at it in this pattern compared to Jim Crow and the Northern and Western ghettos, and before that compared to slavery, and when you start to look at these little moments of change and tumultuousness in between, it helps us to locate where we are today.
Yes.
You know? So my purpose in bringing out these arguments is, first of all, to say that we cannot ignore the role of race and racism in all of this. And if we do, there's a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it's to say that we are right now in the beginning of another phase, like the Civil Rights Movement and like Reconstruction, where the practices that have been in place to segregate and to achieve this racial containment are starting to be questioned, and they're starting to be in a phase of disintegration. And so it's really important that we're starting to get involved right now,
right,
because there's this possibility of shaping what comes next, and also because there's the danger that whatever comes next will just be the next iteration, right? And so chances are that's what's going to happen. You know, chances are there's going to be a new surveillance technology amalgamation that comes in and is like the next form entrenching racial segregation. Mm-hmm. The point is that we have an opportunity in this particular moment to really think hard and get involved so that we can potentially shape things in a way that gives us the best possible shot,
yeah,
at taking advantage of this moment. Stop falling, stop falling. I'm here in the studio with Melissa Salazar. Thank you so much for being here. And maybe we could talk a little bit about how we met.
Well, I was given your information through somebody that I previously was working with, and I read the description of your class and decided that I wanted to participate in it for many reasons. Obviously, incarceration has impacted me personally, and it's something that I do talk about because I'm not ashamed of it, and the fact that, like, it is my brother who's incarcerated. Also, I've been in different situations where I've gone to these readings or talks, conferences about prison, and have realized that there's very few people who attend these who have had that experience, or, you know, supporting someone incarcerated. And so I know that, like, when I go into these type of settings, that I'm preparing myself to possibly be the only person there willing to openly talk about it.
Yeah. And do you feel that that's kind of a responsibility that you have then? And do you experience it as a burden?
I would say it's a little bit of both. Definitely a burden, because I do see where people want to help. You can go in and you can volunteer, but until you have to go through the stages of knowing, like, okay, here's my brother. He's sitting in a county jail. We know he's about to get shipped out, or as they say, catch his chains, because he's been sentenced. And then I get the phone call from a family member, well, from my other little brother, saying he's caught his chains, he's gone. And then now you wait, because you don't know where he's going. You know, you have no idea when he's going to be able to contact you. Mother's Day, my mom and my aunt go to see him, and he's not there. Hmm. When I went to see him last year during Christmas time, there was a lady who had came all the way from Georgia to see her son. She gets there, and I'm standing behind this woman as they're like, well, he's not here. And she's like, but I called, and y'all told me he was here. They're like, no, he's not here. So they search their system and tell her, okay, he's at this unit. Well, this is a woman who's from out of state, and I remember just saying, like, I'm going to be able to see my brother. I know he's there. So I took the time to get out of line and talk to that lady and tell her this is the best way to get there. And we're standing in this parking lot of a prison with, you know, her phone pulled up, and I'm showing her, like, this is where you go. So it's a lot of the small things that people don't take into account and the way it plays on your mind.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit. So you're from Texas.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how your life has been impacted by mass incarceration?
Yeah. So I grew up in a town in Southeast Texas. And when I was there, I never thought about mass incarceration. Like, the term mass incarceration was something I never heard of. And it was because it was normal.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody I know has had some type of run-in with the law or has been incarcerated. So I never thought twice about it. When I left Texas and moved here to Portland, as I'm in college, my brother gets in trouble for his second drug offense. I mean, you can pull up his record and it's no more than two charges on there. But then going through that process and reading The New Jim Crow at the same time and seeing it play out that same way, I think I was the only one who wasn't surprised when they hit my brother with 8 years. And it was the weirdest thing to see that his charges carry between 5 to 99 years. Like, what is that? Of course he's going to sign for 8 years.
Right.
And then because it's his second drug offense, he has to do a mandatory minimum of 5 years. So he's not even going to see parole until the summer of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
He just celebrated his 26th birthday on September 26th in there. And that's where he's growing up at, because of the mistakes he made when he was 18 years old.
I know from some of our previous conversations that you also have a couple of cousins that are serving really long sentences, mm-hmm. also for non-serious, non-violent crimes. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there is this thing, like, where you have to come to the realization of who they are and how this happened. And when I was in Texas, I was very much black and white. I was that, no, if you're in prison or if you're in jail, you're there because you belong there.
Mm.
And that's what happens. You're a bad person. rehabilitation was never something that was on my mind, as it's black and white there. Those are the consequences to your actions. So when I think about my cousins who are serving this time, and I realize like they were just as young as my brother, and because there was not like focus on that rehabilitation, and it was just consequence, 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 they had that mentality. That mentality started building up in them, and that's who they are. You know, I won't say his name, but sure. The cousin that I have talked about, 99 years for theft because of his previous convictions. That's what he got. And he got in trouble young with drugs. I mean, now when you look at it, and well, when I look at the whole situation, I see he also had a drug problem. And we just washed him off to the side. I am very open in admitting where I failed. And that was, I failed in not being there for the support, you know, and then we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Because it's shameful.
Right.
And I think that that's what hinders my community the most, is that shame and stigma, because then you don't look further into it. When I really started looking into it and looking at, you know, the whole history of all of it, I was blown away. I mean, I was actually so frustrated to the point that I almost shut down in college, because I'm looking at the same things happening in this college setting, you know, and these kids who don't look your typical, you know, type of people who would mess around with certain things and stuff like that, but it's everywhere.
Right. You're talking about drug use specifically, yeah. Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. College campuses are like bastions of drug use, right?
Yeah. And I'm just, I was floored, because yeah. Here I am and I'm like, wow, my whole world is changing around me. And it was really hard because then my family couldn't understand it. Some of my friends couldn't understand it. The things that used to be funny to us and that we would joke around about, I was the one sitting at the table quiet. And it's like, well, what's wrong with you? And I can't laugh at that anymore.
All right. Here comes a call from Melissa's brother.
Hello. This is a free call from
Marcus Salazar.
An offender at Clemens Unit. This call is being recorded and is subject to monitoring. To accept this free call, press 1. To refuse this free call, press 2. To learn how to quit, thank you for using CenturyLink. You may start the conversation now.
Hello.
Hey, sis.
Hey, little brother. We were just talking here, so I was just telling Nicole about the realization I had and how I began to shut down, and the family and friends couldn't understand where I was coming from. And how certain yeah. things were no longer funny anymore, and I just couldn't, you know, be a part of it.
Yeah. So, hi, Marcus.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for calling in, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So Melissa was kind of talking about how really there's a lot of shame and stigma around being incarcerated or having family members that are incarcerated that kind of can prevent people from looking more deeply into the history.
Yeah, we talk about this all the time, and I love talking about it now because the world needs to know about this system and the effects it does have on family members. Going through it firsthand, you know, my eyes really are open now to what I'm going through, and it don't just take a toll on a person going to prison. It takes a toll on the whole family. You know, my sister sending me books and sharing the knowledge that she's gained about this prison system with me. It's tough, man. You know, people really, how do I say this? I mean, I don't know if ignorant would be the right word, but they don't know about the prison system.
Yeah.
You know, kid, growing up, you know, I see a lot of people, friends, dads in prison, cousins, uncles in prison, and they just think, oh, you know, it was his fault. And then he comes home and he messes up again. And they're like, oh, well, he just messed up again. But it's tough. It's tough. Being a convicted felon, the way the system is designed, I see that
There's so many restraints on the felon. When you get out, you can't get a good job. Before I came to prison, I was already a convicted felon for probation, a felony possession of a controlled substance. And I couldn't get an apartment in a good neighborhood. And, you know, whenever you think, oh, I'm just a felon, there's nothing good for me. People resort to the old way they used to live. And low-income neighborhoods are trying to get fast money because the jobs they have don't pay too good. And see, like we talked about it, sis, I was a pawn in a game that I knew nothing about.
Mm, yeah.
And if people don't see themselves like that, like when they come, oh, I'm just a felon. Says, no, you can learn this game too. You can learn the rules, the way it's designed. You don't have to live the way you used to live. And it's not easy. It's not easy at all. But, you know, you got to want to change, and you got to do something with your time and use your mind. Like I appreciate you sending me these books, because if it wasn't for the books and me wanting to change the way I used to live, there's no doubt in my mind I could just be another, I'm just a felon, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that I'm really hearing you say is, like, you have to swim upstream to get out of the cycle of incarceration and, you know, maybe selling dope or whatever it is, right? Like, that, like you can't, like, if you just go with the flow is just going back and forth into prison your whole life.
Exactly.
But, yeah, and then it also sounds like one of the really powerful things about learning about the history and the way that the system is structured is that it can kind of motivate you to swim upstream.
Yeah.
There is a game that's going on, and when you're not aware of the game, then you're not going to try to play it. But once you're aware that there's a game, then you can learn the rules just like anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's just one thing me and Melissa have talked about. And not only is she my sister, but she's a great mentor to me.
Mm.
And she helps me see all these things. And I like what you said about you got to swim upstream, because if you just go with the current downstream, you're just going to lead back to that big old body of water where everybody's just saying, I'm a felon.
Yeah.
See, a book that I read, the system that this government designed, they designed the way if we can control the way these people think, we don't have to worry about how they act.
Mm.
If we label them a felon, then, oh, I'm just a felon, we know how they're going to act. They'll stay right here in their place, and we don't got to worry about it. As I go through this, I look around, I'm like, dang. And it really, like I was talking to my sister, it really hits me hard, because all the units I've been on, majority of the inmates are blacks, African-Americans, and Hispanics.
Yep.
And the blacks and the Hispanics, these classes I'm in, all they say is, oh, I'm just, when I get back, I'm going back to the hood and da-da-da. And, like, they don't take the time. And I tell my sister all the time, but like, it really hurts me, because I was that person before. I was that person. And I share, when I'm in class, I share with them all the stuff that I learned. And the reaction I get from them is like, oh, okay, dang, man, appreciate you sharing that. And they write it down. You can't just listen to it. You got to really apply it to your life. And it's tough, you know. It's tough whenever you're used to thinking one way, you know.
Yeah, I was telling Nicole, Marcus, that Carlos went to visit you, and I didn't know that he went, and he posted that picture of y'all two on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of your friends commenting on there, and there were some people that were incarcerated with you when you were at Dominguez Unit. And
yeah.
I was telling Nicole, like, it was very humbling to see all of the good things that people were saying about you. About how humble you were, how you've grown up a lot in there, and that you have a different way of thinking. And one guy was like, that boy likes them peanut butter pancakes. So I wanted to ask you, what is that?
Oh, yeah, that's what they serve us for breakfast at Dominguez every morning, peanut butter and pancakes.
Okay. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, they used to serve that a lot to us over there. And, But, you know, for example, Melissa Carlos, he did 2 years Ed Dominguez, stay jail.
Yeah.
He's a convicted felon. Now, the conversation we had yesterday, it was beyond the street mentality that we both used to have. We sat down, he's like, okay, bro. When he walked in, he said, man, you look great, Marcus. He's like, man, I haven't seen him in over 3 years. He's like, man, bro, you look great. You're in great shape. You look fit. You look healthy. He's like, man. And I was like, man, appreciate you. So we sat down, we started talking. He goes, so what do you want to do when you come home? Business-wise. What kind of business do you want to do? And so we started talking. I started sharing ideas with him. I was telling him about the hot shot. You know, I would like to get my CDL and maybe start a hot shot business. He said, think beyond that, Marcus. Think beyond that.
Nice.
And he just started, him and his girl, they just started their own business about maybe 3 or 4 months ago. They got a cleaning business. They got contracts already with different companies. And he just talked to her dad, and they're about to start up another business. They're going to start cleaning construction sites for different companies. So he was a convicted felon and had the street mentality, but he turned the negative into a positive. Whenever he came down, all he did was read books, put together plans for the future, set goals, and when he got out, he put them in the motion.
Yeah, I love that story too, because something that I've seen and I've heard other people talk about too is how, like, you know, the skills that somebody has when they're, you know, in the street life can translate into managing your own business and having that entrepreneurial mindset and running your own business. If you can kind of get over the fear of that and really get motivated to do it, it's like that's a great way of getting around a lot of the hiring discrimination.
and it's right. You can take all the skills that you use to the street mentality as far as hustling and all that stuff, and you can use it in a positive way. You can. It's like, I was telling Melissa, whenever I came to prison, I had two choices. I had the choice to make this the worst experience, the worst thing that ever happened to me, or I could choose to make this the best thing that ever happened to me. And I chose to make it the best thing that ever happened to me. And I never allowed my environment or the circumstances that I'm going through to be bigger than my happiness, you know? I just stay focused on being a better person, not going back to the old thinking. And I use this, incarceration can give you a sense of empowerment. Like, oh, I went through this fire and it didn't break me. And now I'm ready to get out. And I could set goals and I could fail at these goals, but I'm not going to give up on doing the right thing. And I'm going to keep on trying.
And I think a lot of that too, a lot of the success comes from the success of knowing that you have, you know, that support. And that's one thing is when we talk about, you know, it being hard, there's some times where I don't even know where you are. Like when you were, you know, getting recategorized, had no clue when I was going to be able to talk to you. And it was, what, almost a month before you were able to call?
Yeah, I know that puts stress on the family members and on me as well, you know. But I know it's tough. When I talk to my sister, she's like, finally, bro, where are you? Where are you? I haven't been able to sleep.
Yeah.
Where are you? I told her, that is really tough. Being away from the family is tough. At times, I go on lockdown. One time I went on a 19 or 21-day lockdown. You can't use the phone. You can shower every other day. And they don't. My family, Melissa, doesn't hear from me, so they're worrying a lot, you know.
Well, and even through the hurricane, I was telling Nicole about what happened and you waking up in the middle of the night to water coming in your cell. And
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the living conditions are, oh man, it's really it's poor living conditions. Even where I'm at right now, when it's cold, it's cold. When it's hot, it's scorching hot. At the trustee camp I'm at right now, it's like you're sleeping outside. All the buildings have no insulation. It's just a little tin building.
And
the
this
window.
Is...
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and this is like a desirable place, right? Like the trustee camp.
Yes, ma'am. People pray and hope to come to places like this.
Right.
These conditions are really worse than the Dominguez unit that I was at. Dominguez was, that had insulation. It didn't have no AC, and when it was hot, it's hot, scorching hot there. And when it's cold, it's cold. But here, I wake up in the morning, and it's like you're camping outside. I mean, it's horrible, you know. But yeah, I mean, you get a little bit more freedom. I can walk around. We got a track. We got a basketball court. We got a weight room. I could go.
You have 1 minute left.
I could go and come as I please. But just being incarcerated is tough, and there's poor conditions.
Yeah. Okay, so we have less than a minute left. Just wondering if there's anything else you want people who are listening to this to know.
I just want people to know the ones who are incarcerated, just want them to know that, you know, this is not the end of the world, and just stay positive, because good things will come from this. You know, share your experience with somebody else, because you can make a difference in somebody else's life.
And as always, little
Thank
brother, before it
you.
Hangs up, I love you.
And Trey Link, goodbye.
Love you too.
Hey, Arnoldo.
Hey, hi, Nicole.
Thanks for coming down to the KBOO studio.
Yeah, how incredible was that?
Pretty
Marcus
incredible.
Calling in. That was pretty rad.
That was pretty rad. Yeah, too bad he got cut off so quickly.
I know, but it was powerful stuff.
Yeah.
I really love what he had to say. You know, that message, you know, he said at the end, you know, for everybody that's in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
I hope that people who are in there get to listen to this podcast somehow.
Ooh, yeah, that'd be nice.
Right?
Yeah, they're going to be cheering that guy, that's for sure.
We have to find a way to make that happen. So here we are, it's the end of episode 2, trying to think about what it is that people need to know.
Yeah, I think you need to let them know about all the resources that are out there if they're trying to find some more info on this. Give them a lot today, a lot for them to think about.
Yeah, but it was really... really just scratching the surface, you know? So, you know, I would definitely recommend that people do a deeper dive on their own. The first place, of course, would be to just read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. It's a great read, accessible. You know, for anyone that has Netflix, the Netflix documentary, The 13th, which came out last year and is directed by Ava DuVernay, is a great, quicker way of getting a similar history. And of course, it supplements what I've talked about today with images and interviews with experts and that kind of thing. So that's a really powerful documentary, and it only takes a couple hours. And then finally, for people who really want to get like hardcore academic theory on this stuff, I would point them to an article by a sociologist named Loïc Wacant. It's Wacquant. He's French, but he teaches at UC Berkeley. And his article is called Deadly Symbiosis, Where Prison and Ghetto Meet and Mesh. And it was published, I want to say, in 2001.
I would also even recommend Angela Davis's Our Prison's Obsolete. That's another book that's pretty informative. It's a short book, too, so.
That's true.
Get an easy read.
Yeah.
100 pages or so, you know, that's a very good book.
Yeah.
It's very thorough, too.
Yeah, and I, you know, might make that recommendation in the last episode of this podcast, which is about all of the movements that are emerging to start dismantling mass incarceration, since Angela Davis is kind of one of the godmothers of prison
she
abolition.
Is.
Yeah, but absolutely, why not get a jump start, you know?
A cheat sheet up.
So with that, then I just want to say thank you to a few people. I mean, first and foremost, let's thank Marcus Salazar for calling in.
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah, and sharing all of his insights and reflections. And then, of course, to Melissa for coming on the show herself, but also having her brother call in, which was a really special thing. I also need to thank Mr. Sean Stewart for helping me with the intro, and Mr. Arnoldo Ruiz for stepping in for Sean tonight, who could not be here.
Yeah, thanks, Sean.
Yeah, and then finally, Mr. Paul Braverman for interviewing me, and we will hear more from Paul and his personal experience with the criminal justice system and the war on drugs next week in episode 3, which will be called This Is Your Brain on Drugs.
Ooh, man, I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be good.
It'll be good. And finally, Arnoldo, can you remind people who are listening where we are right now?
I believe we're at KBOO.
KBOO, KBOO.FM, Portland.
Yes.
Yes.
P-Town.